10 years ago, you know, there was absolutely no engagement between the two. And it's quite fascinating, given all of the human rights impacts we know related to drug laws, you know, whether that's things like the death penalty, whether that's, you know, right to health issues, you know, spread of HIV infection, whether that's exploding prison populations.
Hi, my name is Miz, and this is Promote the Hell Out of It, the podcast where I talk to people worth promoting about subjects I think are worth talking about. And this is an episode I've been extremely excited to share with you all. I talk to Dr. Rick Lyons, Associate Professor of Criminology and Human Rights at Swansea University. Dr. Rick Lyons is a key figure in the emerging field of human rights and drug policy. He is known for his research on subjects including international drug control law, prisoners' rights, HIV and human rights, capital punishment and harm reduction. He also has a book out, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law. And I am only scratching the surface. I found this conversation absolutely fascinating. As you can probably imagine, we cover a lot of ground. We talk about the history of drug control. We talk about how it contradicts a lot of human rights laws. We talk about what is being done and what is in future for international drug control, as well as a lot more. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. And without any further ado, here it is.
No engagement between the two. And it's quite fascinating, given all of the human rights impacts we know related to drug laws, you know, whether that's things like the death penalty, whether that's...
Thank you so much for talking to me, because I know how valuable time is.
No, thank you so much for asking me. It's great to be able to participate.
I have a lot to ask you, and it is a bit difficult to know where to start, because it's a subject that I want to make sure anyone can listen to this podcast and follow along with the conversation. The first thing I wanted to ask was, what drove you to be interested in this subject? Because it is extremely specific, and I'm really interested in knowing where it all started for you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's something that I talk about quite a lot as sort of a warm-up when I do presentations. Because I've spent probably the last 20 years or so, at least, specializing in one way or another in issues related to drug laws and drug policy. But the truth is that, you know, on some level, I really don't have any real issue in drug laws and drug policy. My interest in the topic and my choosing to focus on the topic comes from my work in other areas. I began my career and still am working in the area of prisoners' rights.
Okay.
And I worked for many years specializing in issues of HIV in prison. And when I was doing sort of frontline service work early on in my career in prisons, working with prisoners who were living with HIV and doing advocacy work for them, I realized pretty quickly that most of them were people who used drugs or people who had used drugs at various times in their lives.
Yeah.
So that sort of compelled me immediately. I needed to begin learning about drug use. I needed to begin, you know, learning about the laws and policies that were having an impact on the lives of the people that I was trying to advocate on behalf.
Yeah, of course.
And similarly, when I was working more broadly on prisoners' rights issues, we know the huge number of people incarcerated around the world as a result of drug-related offenses.
Yeah.
So again, it became very obvious to me that if I was someone who was interested in trying to advocate for the rights of prisoners, to advocate against prisons as a social response, you know, as a primary social response for the criminal justice system, that required that I grapple with and get to terms with understanding the impact of drug laws and drug policies on the expansion of the prison complexes in many, many parts of the world, including here in the UK. So when I sort of boil it down, I tend to say, you know, the reason I do a lot of work on drug laws and drug policy isn't necessarily because I'm interested in drug policy, but it's because bad drug laws and bad drug policies have an incredibly negative effect on other issues that I do care deeply about. Again, whether that's prisoners' rights, whether that's HIV, whether that's racial justice. And so therefore, you know, if you want to do effective work on those issues, it kind of compels you to have an analysis and an understanding and an appreciation of the impacts of drug laws and drug policies on all those issues.
Absolutely. I think that's really important. And I think that the scars of how drug control has been enforced for so long are easily seen to anyone who cares to take a look. But what I was really interested in was I started reading the introduction that you sent over to me before our conversation. And it was in the different stages that you mentioned of international drug control in what sparked everything off, because obviously we all think about drug control in terms of what we know from the media, what we know from our lifetimes or our parents. But could you maybe expand a little bit on what the origin was?
Sure. I mean, well, I think maybe just to start with the current day and to work backwards, I suppose. I mean, the important thing, again, that sort of underpins all of my work on drug laws. I mean, the important thing to understand about drug control as, you know, whether it's an ideology or a, you know, a social or political project, or whether it's a framework of laws, however you look at drug control as an objective, it has the objective consequence of legitimizing and strengthening the authority of the state, whether that's by creating frameworks of laws and policies and policing that obviously gives additional powers to the state, whether that creates a sort of an ideological rationale about the need to suppress drugs, which therefore justifies the increased state authority in all these areas. And the rationalization in that regard is really key, because we have to think that the idea of suppressing drugs, which is the language that was kind of used 100 years ago, opium suppression, you know, trying to eradicate the use of opium at the time. You know, that, you know, as kind of a social project or a political project, that creates a state justification for interest and engagement in some of the most kind of intimate and private parts of our lives. It creates a justification for the state to have an interest in what we do with our friends, you know. It gives them an interest in what we do in our own homes, in the privacy of our own homes. And it creates a legitimate state interest even in kind of the most intimate decisions about what kind of intoxicants we choose to put into our own bodies, you know, whether that's for recreation, whether that's for pain relief, whether that's for socializing. So drug control in the modern era, again, it's created this vast, as we understand it, framework of laws and criminal laws, particularly, and agents to enforce those criminal laws, while also in parallel to that, creating this justification, this kind of moral and rationalization for why the state's reach into those private areas of our lives is in some ways legitimate. And this, you know, kind of modern incarnation of it, evolves really side by side. I mean, it's something that I wrote about in the book. If you look back at kind of the earliest period of what we would call international, you know, kind of drug control, dating from sort of 1909 with the first meeting of the International Opium Commission in Shanghai, you know, you had people at that meeting talking, seriously talking about opium suppression as being the next major international collective humanitarian project, following on from the abolition of slavery, you know, in the 1860s. Like, seriously talking in those kinds of terms.
And in terms of that, hadn't it at a similar time been referred to as an economic commodity, which is quite polarizing to it being a humanitarian issue?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And that's been, again, sort of the push and pull of drug control from the very beginning, because, you know, drugs, whether that was opium, you know, kind of in the 19th century with, you know, the British government and British industrial interests having, you know, colonial interests having monopoly control of opium production, essentially. And the British government, even though it frowned upon kind of the trade and the industry, at the same time was reaping, you know, a large amount of revenue from that. It was helping to fund the colonial expansion of the British Empire. in the 19th century, you know, large parts of that were helping, you know, were financed by the opium trade.
Yeah.
And by opium being produced in India, which was, of course, a British colony at the time, and being sold, you know, sort of generally illicitly, really, into China. And, of course, this prompted in the 19th century sort of two wars between Britain and China. You know, interestingly, at the time, you know, the basis of those wars that were launched by the British were to essentially to keep their markets open,
yeah,
was to safeguard their markets, because British traders, you know, were selling the opium into China. The Chinese authorities, the Chinese emperor, sent troops in, seized the ships eventually, and, you know, Britain went to war essentially to be compensated for that and to maintain their markets. So it's a bit, you know, again, might say the first drug war in history was a war from, you know, the West to maintain their economic control of opium as a commodity.
Yeah.
But again, when we see the getting back to the question you asked originally, I mean, one of the things that we see in the evolution of drug control over the last 100 years is, again, part of this rationalization and this ideological framework, which very much grows out of kind of the, you know, the temperance movement at the beginning, you know, the anti-alcohol movement,
yes,
in the US, for example. The idea that somehow intoxication is a sin,
moral
or
vice,
it's equated,
yeah,
a moral vice related to sin. And we see that as a result, you know, people who use drugs, and we still see this today, you know, are sort of equated with being kind of chemical slaves.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Deprived of all agency, deprived of all dignity, deprived of any capacity to reason or make rational decisions about their own lives. And therefore, the drug control, the state is essentially going to come in and rescue these people,
yeah,
and save these people. And we still see that rhetoric today, even in some of the United Nations documents, this idea of chemical slavery, which is a bit, I mean, hideous, really, as a concept. But because of that kind of growth, a parallel growth of, you know, the increasingly punitive legal framework and the increasing use of criminal law as a main tool of drug suppression, you know, sort of from the 1960s onwards, evolved hand in hand with this idea that, you know, suppressing drugs or eradicating drugs was some kind of humanitarian mission, this joint humanitarian mission. And that language is used explicitly if we look at the old sort of the old original international drug treaties, you know, sort of drafted and adopted during the League of Nations period in the 1920s. You know, they specifically refer to, you know, drug suppression as a humanitarian effort. And that's, you know, sort of useful on a couple of ways. You know, I said it does create this kind of like moral legitimacy of the state, as I was saying earlier, to, you know, reach into the private areas of people's lives and creates an interest of the state in what would otherwise be seen as private behavior. But it also, you know, served a utilitarian purpose of, you know, keeping in mind that it's only really in the last, you know, 30 years of drug control that, you know, drugs is being seen as this kind of multinational problem, you know, problem in inverted commas.
Yeah.
But before that, you had, you know, a small number of states who were really committed to the idea of opium suppression or cannabis suppression, and lots of countries who didn't really have a particular vested interest in it at all. But by framing, you know, drug suppression as this joint humanitarian mission of the international community, you know, it creates a way to get other countries who otherwise might not be interested in changing their domestic laws around drugs to somehow come on board with the anti-opium and the anti-drug campaign.
Yeah, that's something I was really interested in, because obviously in order for it to work, as many people, as many countries as possible need to be involved, but you need to push a sense of shared purpose for that to happen. Is that why we see the kind of language that has been used for so long, both in terms of referring to it as a humanitarian purpose, but also apocalyptic language, provocative sort of analogies that are used?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a variety of things. I think certainly early on, and some of the, you know, some of the kind of the earlier writers talk about this quite specifically, about, you know, framing it as this shared international cause, as you said, this shared mission, you know, actually had sort of a utilitarian purpose. And there was one, I can't remember who actually wrote about this, but they said, you know, the United Nations sort of as the body to progress international drug control. They sort of said, well, you couldn't really have been as successful as you have been in progressing international drug control if it wasn't done under the auspices of what is seen as an altruistic, you know, multinational, you know, international community body like the UN. The fact that it's being done through there, the UN, of course, also being, you know, the home of promoting human rights and pushing forward human rights standards and economic standards and environmental standards, you know, the place where countries come together to address these big and important human issues, you know, having drugs as part of that remit really gave it a sort of credibility and a sort of, you know, sort of moral strength that it might not otherwise have enjoyed, particularly early on. I mean, obviously the drug, sort of the illicit drug economy has changed sort of very, very much. And, you know, many more countries now affected either by, you know, drug trafficking or by drug-related violence or by drug-related health harms than there were, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years ago. So in many ways, you could argue that's actually as a consequence of the current system rather than the current system being a response to that.
This is what I was going to ask. When you heighten this sense of fear against drugs, has that had a direct impact on what people are willing to do in order to catch drug offenders and how they're willing to treat them as well?
Of course, you know, those of us in kind of the current era are all very familiar with, as you mentioned, the kind of apocalyptic language about drugs, you know, drugs being a threat to, you know, democracies and human dignity and, you know, the survival of people and the threat to children and a threat to families and this sort of thing, destabilizing force. We're very familiar with that in the kind of current drug control discourse. But it wasn't always like that. And I say one of the things I did in my own research was tracked the language of drugs primarily through the United Nations General Assembly. Say the General Assembly has adopted well over 100 resolutions concerning drugs since, you know, the 1940s. And you can really see a pivot point in sort of the mid-1970s where all of a sudden the language changed, where for the 30 years up to that point, drug control resolutions tended to be very dry and technical sorts of things. You know, they didn't really have, you know, any kind of, you know, fiery language attached to them.
Okay.
But again, you get into the 1970s, you see that pivot. And say in the book, I actually point to a specific resolution where all of a sudden you start to see this language. And it's very, very clear when you actually read, you know, when you read the resolutions chronologically from sort of 1946, 47 up until 1975 or whenever it was. And then you get into the kind of language that we're familiar with about drugs being this kind of existential threat to the global community. And again, as I said at the beginning, it's like keeping in mind that drug control as a body of law and as an organizing principle for societies has the impact of legitimizing and strengthening the state. You know, this would be a kind of language that governments, I think, would be very comfortable with by and large, because it strengthens, and as you said, strengthens and the rationalizations about why they should adopt more extreme laws, why they should hire, you know, more police, why you should get the military involved in policing operations, you know, why you should invade other countries or, you know, give military aid to other countries. Under the auspices, allegedly, of fighting drugs, when in many times it's really just about, you know, Western countries supporting their proxy state allies and in other parts of the world. So, I mean, drug control becomes a very convenient cover for a lot of these kinds of, you know, what are otherwise, again, utilitarian actions of the state to advance its own power, whether that's domestically or internationally. And you know, that's something we see still going on today. And I say in a lot of the negative impacts that I think we see of you know, the war on drugs today is very much a consequence of that increasingly punitive criminalization, militarized approach to addressing drug use and drug markets.
Yeah, it's really interesting how many people are hurt as a consequence as well. I remember growing up and listening to people talk about addiction as an evil that was really horrific. But in order to combat that, the amount of other people that are hurt, the amount of industries that were damaged as a result of drug control, like growers, like people who, especially in Southeast Asia, when I traveled around there, which before drug control made a lot of their income of those things. Was that ever thought about? Was that ever actually discussed as part of the treaty?
Well, I mean, one of the things about, I mean, and there have been like lots of people who've written very good investigations, historical investigations of this around the evolution of drug control, is you can see the degree to which, you know, it's very much a demarcation between what would have been, you know, the colonial powers and the colonized states, colonized parts of the world. If for no other reason, by looking at what types of intoxicants were seen as being worthy of some kind of collective international response. So, you know, famously, you know, alcohol, you know, the drug of choice of, you know, Europe, the drug of choice of the United States, you know, is not something that's subject to international control, despite the fact if you're looking at, you know, health related harms, you know, interpersonal violence, all the things that we know, you know, for people who study criminology or people who study public health, you know, the very many negative consequences related to alcohol use. And in many cases, much more severe kinds of public and health consequences than you get from many of the drugs that are actually criminalized. You know, alcohol is famously not even talked about in the context of international drug control. Tobacco, you know, nicotine, again, is famously not talked about in those contexts. So, you know, and that's kind of carries through the entire history, really, of drug control. And again, it's not an area that I've specialized in, but I read others who specialize in this, is the degree to which, you know, the evolution of drug laws, particularly, you know, in the last 100 years, has been very much about defining others. So, you know, the drugs that we seek to prohibit and criminalize are not the drugs that, you know, we ourselves use. And I say we, you know, the royal we as sort of the, you know, the white, economically secure, politically privileged, economically privileged classes in any countries. It's always the drugs that, you know, other people use, whether those are, you know, immigrant laborers, whether those are, you know, poorer people, working class people. And those are the drugs that are seen to be problems.
Of course.
Whether that was, again, opium originally, or later, you know, cannabis and coca and cocaine related derivatives. You know, those are the intoxicants that are labeled as the problems, which again kind of, you know, shows very clearly where power rests. And, you know, we obviously know that, you know, law is about power and who writes the laws and how the laws are written very much tell you about, you know, who has the power in that relationship of drafting laws. And that's as true in international law. If you're looking at which states have, you know, power and influence in those things, as it is, you know, in drafting domestic law. I say, but it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the idea of drugs being evil. One of the things I've written and spoken about quite a lot is in the very first United Nations drug treaty. We should say, you know, you mentioned the stages at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, drug control law, international drug control law, which is what I study primarily, has evolved through a series of stages. So, and I say I base this on kind of an earlier interpretation from the 1920s by a U.S. Legal academic named Quincy Wright. So talking about kind of the first stage of drug control being that drug control of the, you know, the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, where drugs were, you know, a global commodity on the world stage, but it wasn't seen as something that was worthy of, you didn't have international treaties around drugs. Then the second stage would have been the early, what we call the early multilateral stage. So again, beginning in 1909 with the International Opium Commission, and then 1912 with the adoption of the first International Opium Convention. The third stage, which Quincy Wright wrote about, which was the stage when he was living, he pegged at the beginning of the League of Nations. And the League of Nations did some very important things in terms of the evolution of international drug control. Primarily, what the League did was create what would become the international drug control apparatus. We had like a political body to address drugs on the international stage. We had international expert bodies. The control of drugs, or, the mandate to do drug control, is actually one of the authorities given to the League of Nations in the covenant, in their foundation document, the equivalent of what would have been the UN Charter at the time. So we see drug control being elevated further into this international issue that countries were seen to collaborate on. And so my work, building on that kind of structure, is to talk about what I call the fourth stage, which is the United Nations period. I said the interesting thing about the fourth stage, and there were treaties also negotiated and adopted during the League of Nations. And of course, League of Nations falls apart during the Second World War. The United Nations is built kind of out of the ashes of the Second World War. And one of the first things the UN does in its very first General Assembly meeting is to seek to reassert international drug control, the international drug control regime. So it was seen as a priority area for the UN from the very, very beginning. And the first UN drug control treaty actually came out in 1961. It was adopted in 1961. And in the preamble of that treaty, which is the kind of the introductory section, which sets the tone for that, for the rest of the document and how it's to be kind of interpreted, it describes addiction to drugs as being evil. Again, which is something that stood out. And I remember when I first started doing work kind of on the international law part of drugs, 12 years ago, I imagine, I thought that was a really odd thing because, evil's not...
It does
not,
sound very strange, yeah.
Evil's not a term you're used to seeing in a legal document or a treaty. I say, evil is something, maybe like in philosophy or art
Catholic
or
Church.
Theology, you might... Yeah, you'd see, religious studies, you might see discussions of evil. It's not something that you would typically see, or it struck me as quite odd seeing that in an international legal document, an international treaty. So I went about looking at other international treaties that have the objective of suppressing or eradicating other types of behaviors that the international community sees as abhorrent or unacceptable, to see whether evil is a common term. And I went through, most of the ones I could think of, the slavery convention of 1926 doesn't describe slavery as evil. The genocide convention doesn't describe genocide as evil. The apartheid convention doesn't describe apartheid as evil. The torture convention doesn't describe torture as evil. The non-proliferation treaty doesn't describe nuclear holocaust as evil. But, in terms of international law, drug addiction is evil.
So why this change?
It's a bit of a nice little comment to make in a speech, but it does have real implications because on the one hand, as I said, it gives you some flavor of that kind of moralizing underpinning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of the drug control treaties. But again, it also, the knock-on effect of that is, well, if you're defining something as evil, that creates, if you want it to, a justification for taking all kinds of extreme measures to combat that evil,
of course,
which is kind of the situation we find ourselves in today.
Yeah, and this is where I find it starts to get really interesting. We've talked about the United Nations, we've talked about the body that deals with drug control there, but they also there's another body that deals with human rights, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Are they working in collaboration? Are they working together?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, certainly at the time I started doing this work, in international law, I said for the first half of my career, my work on drugs was very much at sort of domestic level, and whether that was providing services for people who use drugs or doing kind of national level advocacy in Canada or in Ireland, where I was living on prison reform and criminal justice reform. When I started to basically went back to school mid-career to do international law, 10 years ago, there was absolutely no engagement between the two. And it's quite fascinating, given all of the human rights impacts we know related to drug laws, you know, whether that's things like the death penalty, whether that's, you know, right to health issues, you know, spread of HIV infection, whether that's exploding prison populations, you know, whether that's all kinds of, you know, police violence and abuse or use of military. There is and always has been a whole range of human rights violations that are integrally linked to drug enforcement. But when I started doing work in international law and drugs, I say 10 or 12 years ago, there was basically no literature on that. There was nothing really in the scholarly literature, you know, the human rights literature looking at drugs. You know, the sort of the Amnesty Internationals didn't really have a position on drugs. If you looked at United Nations human rights bodies, they really hadn't done anything thematically on drugs. There might be a mention here or there of something linked to the death penalty. And it was to the point where there was sort of a very famous speech given by Professor Paul Hunt, who was the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to health at the time.
Okay.
So basically the UN expert on the right to health. This was in 2008, I think it was. He gave a speech at a big international conference where he was talking about his own work. And he would say how frustrating it was because he'd go to Geneva, which was the home of the UN human rights system, and, you know, talk about human rights, and that was fine. And then he'd go to Vienna, which was the home of the UN drug control system. And he said you could talk to the representatives of the same governments and they'd have completely different opinions on drugs and human rights. So his famous sort of phrase at the time was that, you know, it was time for the UN human rights system and drug control system to cease working in parallel universes. And that's been a big focus. And I think that's one of the areas, if we tracked the development of, you know, human rights and drug control, which is what I actually specialize in, we have seen some significant progress over the last 10 years. And that progress has largely been driven by civil society organizations, non-governmental organizations who've taken up the issues related to drugs and human rights. Again, whether that's coming from, sort of a law enforcement perspective or a health perspective, or, you know, the increasing presence of organizations of people who use drugs, you know, taking the stage, or organizations of small farmers and peasant farmers talking about their issues and the other economic livelihoods, you know, linked to producing, you know, small crops of coca or opium. So there has been increasing success in this regard. And we actually had quite a major milestone earlier this year when we published international guidelines on human rights and drug control. And this was a project that was a 3-year project that held expert meetings all over the world. It was a project driven by the UN Development Program and also an organization that I'm affiliated with called the International Center on Human Rights and Drug Policy, which is at the Human Rights Center at the University of Essex. And so we published the final guidelines just in March. We recently had an expert meeting in Geneva sponsored by the High Commissioner for Human Rights to help us finalize sort of some additional commentaries to flesh out the guidelines. But again, that's been sort of a 10-year period, moving from, you know, sort of the start of that process where there was basically no mention of human rights within drug control meetings, and there was really no mention of drugs within human rights meetings, to a point where we do see some engagement. And certainly both of those systems now know that they have to take account of those issues. Again, the big challenge for those of us who work on these issues now is moving from, you know, we've succeeded in moving from silence, I suppose, to discourse. But now the thing is to move from discourse to actual action and implementation. And that's obviously, in most kind of human rights campaigns, that's always the big issue. It's easy for organizations and companies and governments to kind of say nice things and change their language, but actually, you know, living up to what that new language implies is a much different sort of struggle.
Yeah, which I'm guessing brings up issues in itself, because there's been so much pressure for all these countries to get behind drug control that how much pressure will there be upon these countries to actually start making changes now?
You know, that's a very, very good question. And I think hopefully the guidelines can provide at least some underlying framework for how those things might be done.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, you know, the vast majority of human rights abuses that happen as a result of drug control happen at national level. And again, we can go through the list, whether that's, you know, the death penalty, whether that's, you know, racist policing and racist yeah. applications of laws, or, you know, over-incarceration and, you know, racial injustice in terms of incarceration for drug-related offenses, or HIV and overdose and other kinds of health-related issues. You know, By and large, all of those are actual issues of drug control as it's implemented in domestic levels.
Okay.
Which means to actually begin to resolve those, you know, surely, you know, international language and international standards has a role to play. But with any kind of movement to change laws and promote human rights, the real heavy lifting of that is done at national level by affected populations, by advocates, by NGOs, by activists, you know, by sympathetic, you know, experts and sympathetic politicians and sympathetic researchers. But that's really the stage. And, you know, and in some countries, you know, that's, you know, a bigger challenge than in others. And also, you know, the issues in different countries, you know, are very, very different. You know, if we look at, you know, the issues in Europe, for example, you know, primarily what would, you know, typically be called as consumer countries, who are facing, you know, crisis and overdose and this sort of other thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different issues from looking at, you know, Latin America, which we typically, you know, there's overlap between all these categories, but would typically in drug control terms be categorized as producer countries, you know, and you have, you know, very serious, you know, issues related to not only violence from, you know, drug cartels for control of markets, but also violence from the state as well.
Yeah.
You know, so very different issues. If we look at Asia, of course, we have, you know, in some cases we have producer countries and consumer countries, but also places where we have very punitive laws about drugs, you know, the predominance of, you know, sort of the use of the death penalty and other kinds of extreme punishments. You know, so in every country or region we're looking at, you know, the human rights issues are often very, very specific. And of course, the ability to change them is, you know, often, you know, dependent upon countries, the strength of civil society, the openness of those societies to actually be engaged, you know, for governments yeah. to actually be engaged by civil society. And a lot of countries, you know, civil society organizing is repressed, if not, you know, criminalized. Places like Russia, for example, you know, where
Absolutely.
People can be prosecuted Absolutely. For advocating on for access to methadone, you know, to treat opiate dependency. So, you know, very, very significant struggles. And I think, you know, one of the big areas where we're hopefully seeing, now that those kind of silos about human rights and drugs have been breaking down, is hopefully we can get more voices. Because for so many years, the only people talking about drug reform were, you know, the drug sector,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
or the harm reduction sector, which is a sector I work out of, or used to work out of, which was, you know, harm reduction sector looking at, you know, healthcare rights and health services for people who use drugs, which, you know, is a very, typically a very, very small part of the HIV sector, which is in itself is not a huge sector. So,
yeah.
you know, the key part is now that hopefully drug issues have been legitimized as a, you know, a significant human rights topic, hopefully that destigmatizes them to the degree that other allies can start to take up, you know, those causes, people working in other areas, people working in, you know, people working more broadly in racial justice, people working more broadly in prison reform, people working more broadly in criminal justice reform, or in, you know, anti-intervention, or in climate change and environment, you know, it legitimizes, hopefully, the impacts of drug control as more of a mainstream issue for other civil society actors, you know, other political people of political influence to engage with without being afraid of. Because I think that was because the rhetoric, as we've discussed earlier, against drug use and against drug traffickers, and drug traffickers being this existential threat to the world community, you know, that had an impact on the willingness of people in other kind of human rights sectors to take up drugs.
Yeah.
You know, because the immediate responses would be, oh, you're just, you know, are you really defending these evil drug traffickers? And it's like, well, it's not about that. It's like,
there's a bigger conversation at stake. Yeah, absolutely. And how about the big change that we've seen in the last 10 years? I mean, you can't talk about drug control, at least in my circle of friends, without mentioning Portugal and decriminalization. Spain's decriminalized. Canada's changed their view on cannabis, as well as South Africa. Has this changed the actual conversation in terms of the effects that this had on human rights? Is this being used as statistics?
Well, to the first part of your question, it's absolutely changed the discussion. I mean, I think it's fair to say, you know, since, again, when I first started going to UN drug control meetings, say in the mid-2000s, not only was there no discussion of human rights, there was no discussion of any policy options other than piling on further, you know, kind of the existing status quo approach of criminalization. You know, some debate around the edges about how we, you know, needed to provide more health services for people who use drugs. But, you know, there was no real fundamental discussion of any other policy options, which always struck me as sort of bizarre because, you know, if you talk about any other major area of public policy, you know, whether it be like taxation or healthcare or environment or housing or, you know, infrastructure, you know, foreign policy, you know, there's people who have very different views on what a government should be doing. But the fact that there were different views was accepted, you know. And, you know, the act, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, universal health care, and some people support it and some people oppose it. And we just understand that people have different policy solutions to address big problems. In drug control, that wasn't the case. It's like there was nobody talking about, you know, well, let's look about decriminalizing possession for personal use. Let's look about, you know, creating legally regulated markets for currently criminalized substances. That just wasn't even allowed in the room, which was sort of bizarre for a group of governments.
What is there a reason? Why not?
Again, I think there's any number of reasons. I think, you know, from the side of the state, as I said, governments generally like drug control.
Yeah, okay, control fair enough.
Drug control provides them all kinds of tools that they wouldn't otherwise have. And also, I just think the stigma against discussing anything other. I said the same with, you know, human rights organizations. I should say when I talk about human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch was the brave exception in that. And Human Rights Watch has been doing amazing work on drugs and human rights, you know, for a long time.
Amazing.
But, you know, the mainstream human rights sector outside of that didn't want to talk about drugs because it was so stigmatizing. And I'm sure that that was true for many governments who, you know, secretly, you know, might want that to take some kind of different path. But again, it's in the last 10 years that has opened up to a large degree. I mean, we initially had a number of Latin American heads of state speaking very specifically about the direct links between drug prohibition and violence in their countries. And, you know, high rates of homicide in their countries, high rates of militarization, and beginning to actually talk openly and advocate openly at the UN that we need something different for our countries because we can't continue to sustain this level of systemic violence in our countries. All of it driven basically by, you know, violence to control markets to sell drugs to the United States and Canada and Western Europe, basically, right? So, they would talk very eloquently about, like, you know, people are being killed in our countries to provide, you know, products for the West. So that opened it up. And then obviously, you know, countries such as Portugal, who decriminalized possession of all drugs for personal use, you know, opened the door. The moves on cannabis by Uruguay, and then obviously the referenda in various U.S. states were very significant. And now Canada, you know, obviously a big country, my home country, moving to legalize cannabis. Again, that's all opened up the debates, and to some degree is, you know, kind of let the cat out of the bag because it's now again legitimized some of these discussions. But at the same time, you know, it's still, you know, while I certainly, you know, support these moves towards, you know, well-regulated legal markets, and again, and there's other people who can talk about this with more expertise than I can, but we know legalizing markets in and of itself doesn't necessarily make for a good thing.
You absolutely know, yeah,
legally regulated markets can be done, or they can be done poorly. They
especially
can be
done,
done poorly,
especially in a capitalist society. Yeah,
and we only have to look at alcohol again for that. You know, we can have good alcohol policy or we can have bad alcohol policy, and we can see, you know, the health and social benefits or harms of each. But that said, you know, removing criminal laws, in my mind, is always a good thing, because whatever, you know, to me, whatever social problem or health problem you're trying to deal with, you know, criminalizing people involved in it, you know, is always going to be a negative.
Absolutely.
So we've seen these moves open up discussions. But again, it's as you open up these discussions, you know, it creates other questions. I mean, certainly in the United States, for example, when we see state level referenda that have legalized cannabis, you know, there's been an increasing advocacy from drug reformers, from, you know, Black community leaders and, you know, racial justice leaders looking at, well, you know, what do we do with, you know, the, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who have criminal records as a result using or selling cannabis.
That's the thing.
You know, things that are now completely legal. So we need to, how do we go back and create a system where we can go back and expunge?
That's the thing. And the people who are still in
prison. The people who are still in prison,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And we know if we're talking about the United States, that there's huge racial disparity in how drug laws are prosecuted. So that means racial disparities in, you know, what's happening in terms of people with criminal records. And, you know, in some states, you know, that can affect whether you can vote. It certainly can affect whether you can actually get a license to grow cannabis legally in the new legal cannabis markets. So, I mean, that creates, again, highlights the issues of racial justice, which are, you know, integral to drug laws in many countries.
Yeah.
It also gets to the question of, you know, what some people could have called cannabis exceptionalism. It's like, okay, well, it's great if we move to a legally regulated market in cannabis, which is, you know, I think is a positive step. But, you know, what about other drugs that are actually much more dangerous, that cause a lot more, you know, harm to people potentially who are using them? You know, the kind of drugs that are driving, you know, pandemic levels of overdose in some countries, again, including Canada. Your Canadians are, Canadian drug reformers and people who use drugs are some of the most vocal and articulate on this. You know, we have a massive overdose crisis in Canada, and it's great that, you know, we've moved to a legally regulated market in cannabis. But, you know, if we need to look at beyond that as well, if we really, you know, if we recognize, you know, so if Canada recognizes, for example, that criminalization of cannabis use in cannabis markets has negative overall effects on a variety of other areas of health and social policy and criminal justice policy, well, that's equally, or if not more true, for other types of drugs. So we can't stop the conversation at cannabis. You know, cannabis has to be the opening of the door, not shutting the door behind.
And I think it's really dangerous as well. The idea of legalization in the current climate we're in gives the power to big corporations to put so much money and marketing behind products. And we've seen this done. We've seen the effects that had on tobacco. We've seen the effects that it has on alcohol. So it seems ridiculous for the next step to be that, the next step to be replicating what's been done and hasn't worked now on different drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's something I think that is a challenge to some areas of the drug reform movement, because, again, I don't want to harp on the United States because the United States gets too much talked about. But at the same time, it's an interesting example of that, because if you look at the main anti-marijuana lobby in the United States, you know, the main group that's, you know, lobbies against legalizing cannabis in various state referenda, who have, you know, celebrities and politicians signed on and this and that, one of their most effective talking points is specifically the point you've just said, that we don't want to turn cannabis over to big corporations, to big tobacco, to big alcohol, you know, to big pharma, and start selling it and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's actually a legitimate point, you know. And in fairness, you know, some of the drug reform community has been very vocal in response, saying, well, yeah, we're not pushing a pro-corporate, libertarian model of drug control. but at or drug legalization. But at the same time, you know, again, it's difficult because for so long there's been no discussion.
But the discussion a lot of the time seems to be revolving about around the economic difference that it can have on countries' climates. And yet drug control was originally talked about as a humanitarian issue. Where is the humanity in the effect it's going to have on people? Decriminalization seems like a way of actually at least not criminalizing people for what they're doing, but still being able to look after them.
Yeah, I mean, I think decriminalization is an incredibly important step. And I think it's important for people listening to understand the difference between talking about decriminalization and legalization, because they tend to get lumped in together, but they're quite different. I say what we see in places like Portugal, for example, is, you know, drug markets are still illegal. So the, you know, the purchasing, you know, drug selling is still technically illegal. But if I'm an individual person who uses drugs, you know, I'm not going to be subject to a criminal charge if I have, you know, a personal amount of cannabis or heroin or cocaine or MDMA or whatever it might be. I'm not going to be prosecuted for having that. So again, it decriminalizes the person on the consumer end, while the market itself still remains a criminal market, and with all the, you know, knock-on negative effects that that results in, whether that's, you know, sort of crime, or whether that's, you know, unclear content of whatever substances you might be taking, or what they're mixed with, or the, what quality they are. But it's incredibly important because, you know, it decriminalizes individual people who are incredibly vulnerable otherwise, you know, to being you know, subject to prosecution. When we talk about legally regulated markets, what we're talking about is actually legalizing the entire market chain, basically, from, you know, legalizing the production, legalizing the transport, legalizing the marketing and the sale and the retail side, and as well as the possession and use. So it's a much bigger kind of process. And again, that's where you have, you know, the real risks of, you know, corporate interests coming in. And that's also where you get very different debates within the drug reform kind of sector about models, because you do have some elements of the drug reform sector who are generally kind of, you know, more right-wing libertarians who come at it from a personal liberty point of view, and the government shouldn't be getting involved in economic markets and markets will solve all the problems. And then you would have the more kind of, you know, left end of the drug reform sector, where I would certainly see myself, which is, you know, this, you know, drug control is about social control. It's about, you know, it's about controlling what are seen as, you know, undesirable populations or vulnerable populations. And, you know, corporations can do that as well. And we want to try to move, you know, a drug policy that promotes health and human rights and social justice and racial justice and economic justice. That's what we want. We want to take away the bad parts of drug policy. I mean, I used to say, an old friend named John Judge, who passed away a few years ago, who was a political researcher and speaker. And he said something to me years ago, which I thought was always very, very clever. He sort of said, well, you know, from his perspective, you know, the purpose of the criminal law was to create a framework in which none of us can live our lives without violating the law. And then the state, based upon its own biases, its own racism, its own economic division, decides which of us to bust. Right? And that's, again, drug control to me was, you know, he said that to me before I sort of started working more formally in drug control. But I mean, drug control to me is the epitome of that, when we see who gets targeted at the sharp end of the drug enforcement stick.
Absolutely.
You know, it's always people who are vulnerable for other reasons, again, which gets back to my original interest and what drew me to looking at issues of drug laws and drug enforcement, was because I could see that in my own work, you know, and the issues that I cared about, whether that was, you know, anti-racism or prisoners' rights or prison abolition or, you know, anti-intervention politics. You know, you could see the way that drugs were used to exacerbate those situations. And so one of the ways you can begin to try to make a contribution within those broader movements is to try to look at the drug influence, the drug control influence, the drug enforcement influence in those situations.
Yeah, well, it's nice because we've done a nice loop with the conversation and ended up right back where we started, which is always is always great. The thing I do want to sort of end with is, what is the next step? We've highlighted the issues with both with legalization and decriminalization, but what is the next step in terms of this fifth stage? What needs to happen next?
Well, I mean, I think, unfortunately, as with any kind of social movement, you know, you make progress and you also have, you know, significant fallbacks.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that certainly I didn't predict, and I think most of us couldn't have predicted 5 years ago when we sort of saw some momentum in terms of opening up the discussion around drug policy reform, opening up the discussion around human rights related to drug control, the rights of people who use drugs, the rights of people who produce drugs. What we didn't see was the resurgence of anti-drug rhetoric as a mechanism for authoritarian heads of state, from people like Trump to Duterte to, you know, others around the world who are riding, you know, the anti-drug, you know, kind of rhetoric again, which had sort of died down to some degree. And again, obviously the most brutal and, you know, criminal kind of context that we see is what's going on in the Philippines, you know, with the mass murder of, you know, over 10,000 people by the state and state actors in the name specifically of fighting drugs and suppressing drugs. I mean, that kind of just naked state criminality.
It's horrific.
Is, you know, is not something I think any of us really would have predicted, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And then, of course, to also to have that replicated in other parts of the world, to have that influence the kind of discourse in other parts of the world, again, whether that's, you know, Donald Trump or whether that's, you know, other leaders in Asia. Of course, the Russian government has always used, you know, anti-drug stuff as a way to crack down on political dissent. So, I mean, that's the real, frightening thing at the moment. Which kind of brings it all back, you know, to the difficulty of doing the work. And it's great, we can make progress, as I said earlier, we can make progress in getting governments to say nice things about drugs and to recognize that drugs have a human rights context. But when it comes to actually modifying government behavior and state behavior and domestic laws, that's a very different thing. And saying the degree to which, you know, anti-drug rhetoric in a really relatively short period of a small number of years has all of a sudden again been used as, you know, this rationalization for mass repression in different parts of the world. I mean, Donald Trump uses, you know, fighting drugs as one of his rationales for building his wall that he wants to
ridiculous.
Build.
Ridiculous.
You know? Yeah. So, I mean, you can see that in that, and that's, you know, that's part of the difficulty, obvious of, you know, making political progress, you know, in any sort of social movement is it's always very fragile. And particularly when you're taking on issues, again, which get back to, as I said earlier, you know, othering people, you know, separating people from one another based upon, you know, the kinds of substances they're presumed to be affiliated with. It shows you that, you know, the really scary kind of power that legacy of drug rhetoric still has.
Yeah.
You know, even though you can look at it on the one hand and, you know, think that, you know, that's kind of silly, kind of over the top language, but, you know, it does have an effect and it exists there for, you know, authoritarian leaders to obviously seize and use successfully. And again, in incredibly horrific ways, if we look at, you know, the Philippines or what's happening, you know, along the southern border of the US. So, I mean, that's the really frightening thing, I think, which is preoccupying many of us at the moment, is how do you begin to deal with those kinds of issues?
Yeah, I think that is the problem, is how individuals feel so helpless in the situation because it's left up to something completely out of their control, which is very bizarre, is specifically growing up in what we consider a democracy, that something like this is still seems completely out of people's control in terms of what can possibly an individual on their own level do to speed things along. It doesn't seem like there's much that can be done.
Yeah, except that, you know, as I said, it's an issue that cuts across, you know, many other areas of of social life and public life. And so from a response point of view, obviously mutual solidarity is important, not allowing ourselves to be isolated from one another by virtue of what we see as our primary issues or the vulnerabilities of different communities. But it is, you know, there's no magic recipe to any of this. It's, you know, say international drug control goes back, you know, over 100 years at this point in time. So it's not something that's going to be remedied overnight. And I say, sadly, what we're seeing at the moment in many parts of the world is a particularly dark period in this. And again, the degree to which drugs and the fight against drugs is used as a very simplistic yet effective tool by authoritarian leaders for you know, nefarious purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if nothing else, at least podcasts like these also help encourage discussion about the subject and help people
absolutely
talk about
absolutely.
It. I've really, really enjoyed talking to you, Rick. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned a lot. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I've really, really enjoyed it. And it's great to have the space to talk about some of these issues.
They're incredibly important. And I'm super glad that we got together. I will link to all your details below so people can get hold of your book, can look up the course that you have at the university and can find out all about you. But thanks again.
Great, thanks so much.
There was absolutely no engagement between the two. And it's quite fascinating given all of the human...
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of Promote the Hell Out of It. Please tell your friends if you enjoyed it. Give us a like, subscribe, give us a follow, give us a review, depending on what podcast platform you are listening to. And another episode that you might enjoy if you enjoyed this one is the one I recorded with Dr. Matt Lodder. He is also a professor at the University of Essex this time, and we talk about the history of tattoos. I found it absolutely fascinating. You might too. Thanks for listening.
You know, there was absolutely no engagement between the two. And it's quite fascinating given all of the human rights impacts we know related to drug laws. You know, whether that's things like the death penalty, whether that's, you know, right to health issues, you know, spread of HIV infection, whether that's exploding prison populations.